In the Great Hall of the Justice League, there are assembled the world's four greatest heroes, created from the cosmic legends of the universe. Superman, Wonder Woman, Batman, Aquaman, and those three junior super friends, Wendy, Marvin, and Wonder Dog. Their mission, to fight injustice, to right that which is wrong, and to serve all mankind.
Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of For All Mankind, a Super Friends podcast. For All Mankind is a read-through show covering DC Comics' classic Super Friends series, which ran for 47 issues from 1976 to 1981. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and joining me this episode is my super friend, Chuck Dill. Hi, Chuck.
Hey, Rob. How goes it?
It's great. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, especially rereading this old gem. I got a lot of kick out of it.
Well, that's good. I had a lot of fun rereading it as well. Of course, we're here to talk about Super Friends number 45. It was on sale March 19th, 1981. But Chuck, since this is your first appearance on the show, I have to ask you, what, if any, history do you have with Super Friends, the comic book?
Well, I would consider it a lot. I was the one who collected the most comics growing up, but listening to you, I didn't collect that much in comparison. I was lucky to get whatever my parents would pick up or say yes to. I didn't have a regular trip down to the store or anything like that. But this, Super Friends, my version of Mountain Comics was when we would move. My dad was in the Air Force, and we would make these long, exhaustive trips across country. My first Super Friends comics were in 1977 when we moved from Texas to upstate New York. And so that's where I fell in love with the comic book, having always loved the cartoon as long as I can remember.
That's a big change.
This particular issue, we were moving from New Hampshire down to Mobile, Alabama.
Oh, Lord. What? Why was the armed services? It seems like all those stories I hear from people whose parents were in the armed services, the changes were always so dramatic. You know, yeah. I never heard anybody say, we went from, New Jersey to Maryland. It was always, no, we went from Maine to West Virginia.
We thought that when we lived in Texas, we thought snow was like icicles on the trees. And then we moved to upstate New York. And I swear, I thought it was Armageddon, that we were all going to die when my dad opened that door, that first snowstorm, and we were completely snowed in.
Oh, man.
But my only constant friend was comic books because we moved so much.
That's sweet. You know, I mean, that's probably... That's probably,
I like the way your voice cracked.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm sorry. There was no tone there at all. Cause I was very similar. I had a very similar, but I don't have the excuse that I was moving from place to place. I guess I was more thinking about my own background. We stayed put in New Jersey. I just didn't have any friends, Chuck. You at least had the built in excuse of having to constantly start over from place to place. So. The other thing it makes me think about, and I've gone on and on and on about this on this show and on Treasury Cast and on Mountain Comics. We got to get you on Mountain Comics, by the way, Chuck. You're talking about you're going from all these different places, right? And there were comic books available to you because there were stores where they were sold.
Yeah.
Where kids would be, you know? Yeah. I mean, I know that most states at this point have comic book stores, but in some places, some states, they're pretty few and far between. And it's just such a shame that this once mass medium has become like vinyl records, you know, it's just a niche thing and you have to really hunt them down. Young Chuck is going from place to place and look, there's comics in a supermarket. There's comics in it. You know, that's such a shame that that's not a thing anymore.
Every place we stopped on those trips, I would run in expecting a spinner rack, or maybe we stopped at a mall. I would want to go to the bookstore, or, There was a stationery store in Mobile, yep. Alabama. Mm-hmm. If anybody remembers those.
Yep, absolutely. That was a big, yeah. They carried all sorts of periodicals and stuff. Yeah, so, yeah. Oh man, that's so. With Super Friends, it was something that it showed up where you tended to be, no matter where you were.
I had a few issues, maybe 5 to 10 issues. And it was my number two title. My first choice was always Justice League.
Yep, me too.
And my second choice was always Super Friends. And I never missed Saturday morning cartoons.
Right.
So, and that's to this day. Those are going to be my favorites. I do read modern comics, but I prefer my exhaustive rereads of older comics.
Right. Do you recall if when you were a kid, you had any discernment that this was meant for kids, like younger kids, that Justice League had a slightly different feel to it than Super Friends did? Or did that occur to you?
Yes. Super Friends did feel like it had a bit of a younger slant. But then I had like an issue of Battle of the Planets, and that based on the cartoon, and that was skewed like to really younger kids.
Mm-hmm.
So Super Friends seemed sophisticated compared to some of the Gold Key comics I would see.
I never saw Gold Key comics in any newsstand that I ever visited. Never, you know, one.
I think that I got a lot of the three packs.
Yeah. Those I saw.
I feel like there was a lot of Gold Key coming to me, and Harvey and Richie Rich and Bugs Bunny in the middle. The middle comic that you couldn't quite see.
Yep. I think, like, if you're a kid buying a comic book, like, just by the sheer average, you're going to end up with a Richie Rich, because there were like 19 Richie Rich titles a month, as they've been chronicling over on Batman Family Reunion. It's like, just by the sheer random luck, you're going to end up with Richie Rich's Billions or some weird title that he had, because there's just so many of them. So
I had an old cardboard box filled with comics, and those would be on the bottom.
I haven't looked. There must be a Richie Rich, I don't know, maybe not must, there might be a Richie Rich podcast out there.
No.
I would love to hear somebody try to chronicle that character's publication history, because it's just, talk about, you know, Batman and Spider-Man's a big task.
I think after Batman Family Reunion, those two would be great to spin off into a Richie Rich podcast.
I completely agree. I've been leaning on them in the private Fire and Water Network thread. It's not working so far, but who knows? I actually will be seeing them both in person not too long after this episode posts. So maybe I can work on them in person. I can really try and intimidate them. That's not going to work. So anyway, like I said, we're here to talk about Super Friends number 45 on sale March 19th, 1981. The main story is called The Man Who Collected Villains. It's of course by E. Nelson Bridwell, Romeo Tangel, and Vince Coletta. Before we get to the plot, what do you think of this cover, Chuck, by Kurt Schaffenberger and Bob Smith?
I love it. I remember staring at it. It was a long car trip, Rob, and I read this cover to cover several times, along with a few key other issues. I, of course, knew who Sinestro was. Had no idea who Hector Hammond or Queen Bee were. And I used to draw back then, like, a lot. Thought I wanted to be a comic book artist, so I would draw every character in this book over and over. And I remember trying to draw the Bushmaster and his crazy little fingertips on my grandmother's floor in North Carolina.
I do not know what your career is now, Chuck, but I'm glad you didn't pursue a career in comics. I think it's probably a really doomed profession for most people. So I'm glad you talked yourself out of it. Yeah, I love this cover too. It's very exciting because obviously it's got characters from the DCU proper, which wasn't always the case. So I can remember seeing this one on the stands and thinking, oh, cool, Sinestro. And I knew who Hector Hammond was, maybe Queen Bee, maybe not so much, but yeah, it was cool. And we've got all five Super Friends, which is great. Yes. Aquaman's barely in it, but he's in it. If he gets credit, he's in there. And then of course you've got these little headshots of, I was about to say the Global Guardians, but they're not christened the Global Guardians yet. It just says guest starring these international superheroes. And we'll talk about it a little bit when we get to the story, but, and we've mentioned this on previous episodes where they've appeared. Some of the character designs for the Global Guardians are kind of goofy. You know, as you mentioned, like Bushmaster with his little suction cup fingers, but like these little headshots, I think they look really cool, like especially Olympian and Red Sun. Like they look like proper cool ass characters that, that look just as cool as kind of the other Super Friends. So I love the little headshot. I think that's terrific.
I was very familiar with Dr. Mist from Super Friends 13, I think, is the one with the giant mole.
Yeah, they're cool. I like them. I like them quite a bit here. And I love that it says, like, next to their names, it has the country that they're from. That's a great little detail. Venezuela. That's great. I think that's so cool. So, okay. So, as I mentioned, the story is called The Man Who Collected Villains by Ian B., Romeo Tangel, and Vince Coletta. We open inside Dr. Mist's HQ, where he has transported the Super Friends and members of the not-quite-yet Global Guardians. Dr. Mist explains why he has called all these heroes to his lair. He shows them the faces of six supervillains and that the Super Friends and the Global Guardians, I'm going to just keep calling them that. They're not yet, but just for brevity's sake, the Global Guardians have to free them from their current prisons. The Super Friends, of course, are dubious about this. And Aquaman asks why Dr. Mist just can't do the job himself. Mist explains that a being known as the Conqueror has a plan to gain absolute power, and keeping the villains in their prisons is a key to it, so he can amass their power. The Super Friends and the Global Guardians head out. Wonder Woman and Godiva release the Queen Bee, who tries to use their efforts to escape, only to be stopped via Wonder Woman's magic lasso. Batman and Bushmaster do the same for Kanjar Roe, who, like Queen Bee, tries to double-cross his liberators. Aquaman and the Little Mermaid find Sinestro and free him, with similar results. We then find the Conqueror, and we see that the villain's weapons, Bee's energy rod, Sinestro's power ring, Kanjar Roe's nuclear rod, are in his possession, and the ones the villain had in their prisons were fake. He has seen that three of the villains have been freed, but that isn't stopping him from going after his ultimate target, Dr. Mist, to be continued. So yeah, this is part one of a two-part story right near the end of this book's run. Ian B was working on a two-parter, which is a little unusual, again, which I think gives credence to the idea that at least at this point, Ian B did not know that the book was about to be canceled. It seemed a little odd to me that he would do a two-parter, but maybe not. Okay, we're going to go through it, obviously, beat by beat, and we're going to have pages from it on the gallery post over on FarandWaterPodcast.com. But overall, Chuck, what did you think of, you know, rereading this story after so many years?
Well, I can't really separate myself from young Chuck in 1981, but I love reading comics like this. I love the individual chapters, the heroes pairing off. So team ups within a team up book. I just love it, love it, love it. But, and I thought about lying to you about this, Rob, but I'm going to come clean. In 1981, I thought that the art was starting to modernize in Super Friends, and I liked it.
Over Ramona Fraiden?
As an adult, that's not the case. I swear to you.
Okay, that's fair. You know, that's okay. You know, we all think dumb things when we're children, Chuck. I mean, I can't. I'm not gonna hold you to that. It's 40 years ago.
There were two things that really got me on this, and that's, well, three things. Wonder Woman was just beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
The way she was drawn. Batman's cowl, there was something I really liked about that.
I do like the way Romeo Tangel draws Batman. I absolutely.
And I hate to say this, but Aquaman's hair.
You like it? You like the
in this kind of issue,
curly fro thing that he's got going on?
I've been blushing listening to your podcast every time you harp on Aquaman's fro. I was like, oh God, I liked that in 1981.
It's not so bad in this issue. There are some other issues where he looks like Christopher Atkins from the Blue Lagoon, which I'm not a huge fan of. But yes, I do think that Romeo Tangel does bring some nice stuff to this work, and he makes it different. And I can understand, you know, look, there were lots of comic book artists that when I was a kid, I didn't like. And as I've gotten older, I'm like, why didn't I like that? Jack Kirby was one. I was not that huge on Jack Kirby. It would depend on the inker. But even then, I was still like, okay. But like Rick Estrada or Jerry Grandinetti, like these are, or Frank Robbins. Frank Robbins, that was a big one.
Yeah.
And I really didn't like Frank Robbins. Like, this stuff's ugly. Yeah. And I look at it now and I'm like, this stuff's awesome. This is energy. What was I thinking? So no, I won't get on you on that. And of course, when you're 10, 11, whatever age you were, you're trying to think of yourself as like older than you are. That's just, that's inherent.
Yeah, being a kid. And my overwhelming thought, it was all of that plus the fact that it was a to be continued. My overwhelming thought was they're growing this title up. They're going into the future. I can't wait for the next 10 years of Super Friends comics to see where they're going.
And young Chuck Dill learns about disappointment in an early, an early age. Yeah. Now, one of the things I do like about Romeo Tangel's take on Batman is that his Batman is a little more like Dark Knight-y. Mm-hmm. That wasn't the parlance at this point. Well, again, no, he was called the Dark Knight, but it was obviously long before Dark Knight Returns or anything. But I mean, Ramona Freyden, for all of her wonderful skills, and again, I'm mega fan, her comic book, her Batman is thoroughly unmysterious, right, as is Kurt Schaffenberger's Batman. But Romeo Tangel, he has a sort of a very clean, even though he's not the inker here, a clean line when he's drawing Batman. And so I do like the way he looks. Now, I will say, when we're getting to the Global Guardians, Bushmaster, he's one of these guys with, he has this big helmet, and then the bottom half of his face is revealed. The Bushmaster cowl, or whatever you call it, obviously the recreation of the Bushmaster's, you know, the animal's head, reptile's head. If you draw that head a little too big, it looks really goofy. And Romeo Tangel draws it a little too big here.
Rob, this is my challenge to you for your next cosplay.
Oh, right. Yeah, there we go. I would never cosplay. Never going to do that. But like, there's one panel here down at the bottom of page 3 where Dr. Mist is talking, and like Copperhead's Bushmaster's head, looks like it sticks out like a full foot in front of his body. So he's like constantly bumping into people. He's like a dog when you put him there, like a cone on their head.
It's Snoopy in a superhero costume.
It really is. So it's like, okay. But anyway, so Dr. Mist explains his plan. I love that Aquaman is like, why don't you just do it? That's great. That's totally, completely reasonable question, Aquaman. But so all the heroes are like, oh, okay, let's do this. Now, I will say I am a little disappointed that of all the Global Guardians that he's pulling from, there's no Seraph. We've been waxing Seraph's car with good reason in the last couple of months. And I wish he was here, but okay. I mean, I guess Seraph's been getting backup. So I guess he figured, why not give some of the other Global Guardians a chance to shine.
That story, that Seraph story that this podcast has been raving about, that's one of the few Super Friends comics I had, and I read the crap out of that thing.
It's so good.
It resonated.
Yeah, man, it really, really good stuff. By the way, everybody, if you haven't listened to our pal Henry Bernstein's podcast about Jewish characters and Jewish creators in comics called Funny They Don't Look Jewish, go check it out, because they've been doing a deep dive into the Seraph stories. We've been covering them here, but then Henry and his co-host have been devoting whole episodes to Seraph, and it's highly entertaining. I love the bottom panel on page 5 where after Dr. Mist explains, and they leave them out, and they're like, off we go. And it really makes me wish that the Global Guardians had migrated to the cartoon. I know that wasn't really a thing, I guess, but it's a darn shame, because they look cool, and I think they might have looked neat in, you know, to see them in the animated form.
I do find it upsetting in the lower right corner where Aquaman is having to check on Little Mermaid as if she's 5 years old.
Yeah, he is looking under his arm like, are you catching? Are you caught up? What's going on?
Are you still there? Everyone else looks very heroic and charging, and he looks like, I don't want to step on her.
He is very, very tiny. I also love, I'm sure we mentioned this when Dr. Mist appeared before, but I love Dr. Mist's headquarters, in that his erstwhile Mist cave is just a giant angry version of his head, which is, man, that's a playset that really should have been made at some point. But, you know, what can we do? We never see how anybody gets into it, by the way, right? I would love to think like that the mouth lowers like a drawbridge, and that's how you go into it or something. That'd be really cool.
And if you're a villain, it traps you, and they're little robots.
Perfect.
In this, yeah.
Perfect. Absolutely perfect. I wonder if he has like a giant key pointing to his head somewhere further off in the out in the jungle. So anyway, then we get to these individual chapters. And of course, this is something that E. Nelson Bridwell did all the time. The Super Friends, virtually every issue. The one difference is, for whatever reason, each of these chapters get their own little heading, which is a very Justice League thing where we literally get logos of our characters, because it says Wonder Woman and Godiva, and they even get their own subheading. So it's Wonder Woman and Godiva, a sleeping bee. And that's just, I wonder why, you know, now after 44 issues of doing this, E&B finally decided, okay, I'm going to kind of break it up a little and give them like little chapter headings like they did in Justice League. I mean, it's totally fine, but I noticed it as a change.
Yeah. Again, one of the things that made me think this Super Friends comic is different. We're headed for major stuff.
Yeah. So Wonder Woman and Godiva help rescue Queen Bee. I love that the minute Queen Bee wakes up, she's like, oh, I'm going to grab my whatever that scepter thing has and try and escape. Like, I love that it's, you know, villains be villaining, you know, like they never, no gratitude, nothing. It's just constantly like, oh, you two idiots set me free. Bye bye, suckers. And it's, you know, up to Wonder Woman to be like, no, come back here. So
not knowing anything better, I thought that, she must be a big Wonder Woman villain, because they're talking to each other like they know. And just from her look, I'm like, she should fight Hawkman.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, she would be pretty cool. Yeah, she was. I knew her. She had been in Justice League a couple of times. That had to be where I knew her from. Was that? But yeah, you're right. But if you don't know, you would think, okay, I guess she's a Wonder Woman villain. Wonder Woman needs more villains. So then we have the next chapter of Batman and Bushmaster. I did notice that, like, it seems like none of the Global Guardians have proper logos. Like, they haven't gotten around to it. It's just some typesetting. But we get Batman and Bushmaster, and they're helping free Kanjar Roe, who is stuck in this cave. Now, of course, Batman knows who Kanjar Roe is because he's fought the Justice League a bunch of times. I like the weird creatures that are in this cave that Batman and Bushmaster have to fight through. But yeah, there are the panels where we see Bushmaster has got those giant suction cup feet, and it's, as an artist, you got to blow past drawing. How does he run with those things? I mean, I know they come out, like distend and then they retract, but they, when he's climbing down the thing, they do look a bit goofy.
So more embarrassment on my part, but I was like, man, this guy, he is the breakout star of this comic.
Why did you think that? Why did you really like him?
There were so many reasons. Like, I found out from asking my parents, Bushmaster was a snake. And he had all these gadgets, but they were themed and incorporated into his costume, and the colors of his costume all worked. And I'm like, I bet he has a wide fan base.
Well, maybe it's up to you to start it, Chuck. I don't know.
I'm on it.
We're 40 years in, but you know, who knows?
I gotta tell you, I did not, previously to the car trip to Mobile, I did not know who Kanjar Roe was, but before I got this comic, I got, I think it was DC Special Blue Ribbon Digest number 11, with the Justice League of America reprinting 100, 101, and 102, and I know who Kanjar Roe is from that, because he appeared in one panel of the Tornado Tyrant story in the back.
Wow. I was trying to think as you were mentioning the stories. I'm like, wait, that's where they go back in time and they rescue the Seven Soldiers of Victory. Was Kanjar Roe in that? I'm trying to remember. It's amazing. I have women that I've dated whose last names I can't remember, but I can remember the JLA 100 is where they go back to rescue the Seven Soldiers.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes at night when I'm having trouble sleeping, I test my memory about, okay, which three heroes teamed up with who and in what order.
Wow. I can't even do that, Chuck. That's impressive. That is impressive. So they get Kanjar Roe. He does the same thing. He tries to grab his cosmic rod or whatever he's got, and Batman has to stop him. So, okay. And because there's this scene of them down in this cave, you get Batman gets a chance to, as we mentioned, kind of look a little more mysterious, you know, a little more Batman-y than he typically would. Again, I think that's, you know, courtesy of Romeo Tango. And then we get the next chapter, Aquaman and the Little Mermaid. And of course, anytime Aquaman gets some solo action, I'm happy about that. And so they find Sinestro at the bottom of the ocean, and he's in this yellow energy cube. Not a cube. No, it's exactly. No, it's a bubble. Actually, not a cube. A cube would be a square. and then we see his power ring is out to the side. And I love that. I like the detail of Aquaman's, like, it won't fit on my finger because Sinestro's fingers are thinner than mine. Okay. Cool. I dig that.
I loved this chapter. I know you're the Aquaman guy, but I'm a pretty huge Aquaman guy myself, and didn't have a whole lot of things that centered on just him. So this was great. The way he looked, like I said before, was dynamic and updated, and how he freed, or the fact that Sinestro and Aquaman knew each other and they had a little bit of a not nice relationship, went miles for me. I'm like, well, of course they know each other from Challenge of the Super Friend.
Right. Yeah, of course. That's where Sinestro is making bagpipes out of his yellow power energy, right, blowing them and attacking Aquaman and stuff. But yeah, no, that's totally true. I mean, that was, I loved Marvel Comics. Look, I loved all comics, maybe not Gold Key, but I loved all, I loved Marvel, but I was definitely more of a DC kid because I just, not that Marvel Universes wasn't blended, of course it was, but DC had just such a rich history. And I loved all that. I just ate it up. You know, I just love that these characters have, like, presumably known each other for, you know, 40 years or whatever. I love that Sinestro tries to escape and Little Mermaid has to rescue him. And she's carrying him by the underpants.
Right.
It's just so wonderfully humiliating for the Weaponer of Kord. And yet he's kind of like, it's actually the kind of thing you would have seen in Challenge of the Super Friends. You know, this kind of like, put me down, you know, that sort of thing.
I love that Aquaman freed him with the clams, but as an adult, I'm looking at the floor of that bubble, which is just wet sand, I guess. How is that working?
Just because comics, Chuck. But yeah, of course you were a fan of Aquaman because you were a member of Foam.
Yes.
Were you not on my late lamented Aquaman Trine blog?
I don't have a Robbie, but I do have a Foam certificate.
There you go. So those are, and we're not making those anymore. So there you go. so then we get a one page epilogue where we meet Conqueror, who is quite buff. I got to say, he's walking around in mostly nude costume. He is ripped, man. Like, he is big, and he has this kind of doofy helmet where he's got little like deer antler sticking out the front. Again, the costume design on this character leaves a little something to be desired, but
again, I'm gonna suggest a cosplay for you.
Yeah,
but I have to point out there's a little bit of a 3D effect in his shorts.
Yes, there is. Thanks, Chuck. That page will be on the gallery for those of you who want to see it. Sean Myers, I'm looking in your direction, but so that's I mean, this guy is, you know, if ENB is setting him up to be kind of a Global Guardians villain because this is his introduction, he kind of fits their aesthetic. Because all the costumes are very ornate. They're way more ornate than you would ever draw somebody if they were going to appear regularly panel to panel to panel, because you'd get tired of drawing them. But that's the whole Global Guardians kind of look. And so he fits in well. And then we see that, of course, he's got this headquarters and he has the original power weapons. And he's like, yeah, these three guys have been freed, but it doesn't really matter. It's really Dr. Mist is my ultimate target. And so that's the end of the story. It's to be continued to move into to next month. So it's you know, like, okay, finally ENB decides this is just too big a story to wrap up in one page at the end of the book. I'm gonna continue it on to the second second installment. So overall in this story, who do you think came out best? Who do you think deserves the best friend award?
Well, I'm selfishly, I'm going to say Aquaman. Little Mermaid went down there. She wouldn't have been able to do any of that without him.
Okay, that seems fair.
But I guess 1981, Chuck would have said Bushmaster.
Yeah, that's right. You were all in on Bushmaster. On the one hand, I want to give it to Dr. Mist because he's the one organizing this whole thing. But it does feel weird to collect, you know, 12 superheroes or 10 superheroes and then be like, all right, you go off and do it. I'll just stay here back at my Mist cave. You know, like, yeah. Well, what are you doing?
You were talking about the main villain's look and how he looked like a Global Guardians villain. And whatever's going on with his beard, I guess that's an ancient Greek look.
Yeah, right. He's got a beard but no mustache, and it's dipping way down. Like,
well, yeah. And it's beaded.
Yes, it is.
It's yeah. It's a very odd look. I've never seen anything like that.
It's a powerful look. It's too bad he didn't get a Who's Who listing. This guy, but I think this and next issue are his sole run in the DC universe. So, villain wise, of course, we're talking about the Conqueror. He would not, as far as I know, appear in any other DC comic other than these two. So he's just kind of a two and done. Again, I'm not reading Ed, so I don't know what happens to him in part two. Maybe he doesn't even make it out. I don't know. We'll find out the next month. So, that's our main story. And so, Chuck, if you want to, we'll move right on to our backup starring Plastic Man.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right. So this story is called One of Our Barbarians is Missing by Martin Pascal, Joe Staton, and Bob Smith. While sailing with Plaz as the boat, Plastic Man and Woozy Wink see a strange sight, a barbarian and a wizard fighting on a rock bridge. They interrupt the melee only to discover that these are two actors in a movie, which our heroes have just interrupted filming. Back at his trailer, the actor playing the barbarian is doing some weightlifting, and he drops the barbell on his head. He then can't remember who he is until he looks in a mirror and sees, oh, of course, he's Carnage the Barbarian. Two ne'er-do-well crooks named Rubberneck and Puttyface find the rogue barbarian and take advantage of him by using him to commit crimes, which involve plans to rob the Bungling Brothers Circus. Plastic Man gets put on the case and interrupts the robbery as it is taking place. After Plaz bonks Carnage on the head, it wakes him out of his stupor, and he helps Plaz stop the crooks by using his immense strength to toss Plastic Man in the shape of a barbell onto Puttyface, knocking him out. So, okay, Chuck, can you, obviously, you remember what you were feeling when you were that age? Did you like Plastic Man as a kid? Were you a fan of
him? I did, yeah. I watched the cartoon, and I knew of him from the comics, but I don't think I had any solo issues of him in it. I saw the ads for him in Starman in Adventure Comics, but that was about it. I always wanted to get Plastic Man comics. But I loved this, and reading this, both then and now, I realize, well, Plastic Man is the most serious character in this story. And which is how the old comics were. And it just works really well. Yeah. And I'm all about that. Even every character in here is a super caricature. Even the FBI boss, with his bald head and his little squiggle. and Plastic Man is just a serious superhero in here.
I absolutely love these stories. We talked about them. Max Romero and I did an episode of Fire and Water where we talked about the Adventure Comics stories, or at least some of them. And then we talked about Plastic Man's appearance in this comic as a guest star. And I said, even then, I wish he had just joined the team. As you mentioned, he was a Saturday morning star. It would have fit perfectly to make him part of the team. I love these backups. I think Martin Pascal had the knack on how to write this character, in that the adventures are lighthearted and obviously comedic, but they're not silly, you know. Right. They feature these very broad characters. All the villains are right out of like Dick Tracy, you know, Puttyface and stuff like that. And I just think they had these down, and I'm really sorry that this feature got ended before it really got a chance to, I'd say, shine. I mean, it got a decent chance in Adventure Comics, and then they gave it a sort of second chance by moving it into the back of Super Friends. But he only got, like, I think three, and then that was it. And then they never basically returned to the feature. And I think I even said to Max in the episode he was on, I really wish these were collected. These deserve a nice, you know, a bit slim Plastic Man trade paperback. I think these would just hold up really well, and they're really funny. Did you have a? I'm sure you were familiar even at that age of Conan the Barbarians, and you kind of figured like, oh, okay, this is what this is.
Yeah, I'd seen the ads and I knew of the Mego doll, but never had any Conan comics. I don't think my mom would have been too crazy about that.
Okay. I used to sneak Savage Sword of Conan into the house when I could get it, because those were a little more adult than regular Conan. By the way, did you have Mego dolls as a kid? You mentioned it.
Oh, yeah. I had all the Star Trek Migos except for Lieutenant Uhura. There's a whole story behind that I won't get into.
Okay.
And I had Batman and Robin, and I had, it wasn't the Mego Batcopter, but it was the other company that made a giant Batcopter and Hulkcopter and Spidercopter. I got that for Christmas one year.
Pretty sweet. Pretty yeah. sweet. Yeah. I love the Migos. Again, is there like a dedicated Migos podcast?
Oh,
there must be, right? There has to be.
Brian Hyler would know.
Right. I mean, he does Pod Stallions, but they talk about lots of stuff. But I mean, I would love a dedicated, I would listen to that. I love every time Chris Franklin does any sort of toy talk on our network, I tell him, please do more of this. Like, I eat it up. Right. I absolutely love when he does toy talk. I mean, if he ever wanted to do a dedicated Mego show, I'd be like, oh man, I would just, yeah.
I would love that. I've got all the superhero Migos except for Wonder Girl. They're on a shelf behind me, all playing in the Hall of Justice.
For those of you, you can't, all of you can't see this because this is a podcast. I have seen where Chuck records from, and it is like a toy showroom. It is a truly, truly impressive sight, the collection you've amassed over the years.
Sometimes I turn on the camera for work. I turn on my laptop camera, and that always gets a reaction from my team.
Do you have any Super Friends branded merch or toys in the collection?
Oh, yeah. Everything I could get my hands on. I got an old box, the display box of the Secret Origins Leaf candy.
Oh, right. I remember those weird little mini comics. Yeah.
That came in. I've got like a Super Friends corner where I've got the poster up, the Alex Toth poster. And surrounding it is all the Figures Toy Company Super Friends versions and the Legion of Doom.
Man, very nice. Very, very nice. So, but yes, overall, I think this is a really solid issue. I mean, I do like the Global Guardians characters, and I love the Plastic Man backup, certainly over Wonder Twins or, God forbid, Jack-O-Lantern. So, overall, I think a really, really solid issue. And so did it hold up over 40 years? Did you kind of get all the, warm? I mean, you're saying it's hard to look back on it, without rose-colored glasses, but right, rereading it now, that you kind of like, oh yeah, I know, I remember why I love this.
Well, I have the benefit of viewing things through the eyes of my 17-year-old son, who would definitely say it doesn't hold up, it's old hat. He reads a lot of comics, but you know what, Rob? It's the coloring that bothers him. The coloring to him looks so old. How it's all separated in flat colors and not mixed.
Oh, wow.
And that was a unique observation that I hadn't realized, that the coloring has just advanced so hugely.
Advanced is a, everybody defines that a little differently.
The printing capabilities, let's say.
There you go. That's absolutely true. Yeah.
But if you ask me, this is my sweet spot. This is where I want to live. I'm finishing up a reread of Justice League, and I'm in 1988. And Rob, I'm not happy. I'd rather be in 81.
I got to tell you, people will post images of comics on Twitter and Facebook and stuff, and a lot of it is the way your eyes are trained is that, like, I look at stuff in the 90s when they were like, oh, we can do more sophisticated color separating, so therefore every single muscle and every character should have a separate tone. And I'm like, I can't look at this. I can't look at these things. They're hideous. Give me flat color any day. That's good. That's like you. That's what I was reared on.
Yeah.
So
all my rereads stop in 1990. I'm not willing to go further.
Luckily, there were 40 gajillion comics published before 1990. Yes. So you got more than enough to satisfy your reading itch there. So overall, what did you think this is was this like one of your favorites of the Super Friends you remember reading?
Oh yeah. I mean, this was to me almost on a par with Justice League because I felt like it was more sophisticated than I had the Super Friends issue where they told the Atom's origin. I guess it was Super Friends number 6. I loved that one. And I had Super Friends number 4 with the rocket guy. And those just seemed like kids' fare compared to this. And I thought, now Super Friends is growing up. We're gonna grow up together.
This is the grim and gritty Super Friends that we're doing. By the way, that character that you mentioned from Super Friends number 4, he's in here. He's a world beater. We see him there.
Oh,
we see
right.
Him in his head. He's one of the 6 villains that Dr. Miss shows them. So I kind of like that. I love that E. Nelson Bridwell is kind of like bringing in one of his own villains.
Yeah.
To sit alongside the more established ones. He's like, oh, now world beater. He's on the same level as Sinestro and Time Trapper and Kenjiro, right? Yeah.
So, sure. Yeah. Yeah. With the benefit of hindsight, you just kind of shake your head.
Yeah. I love that design, but I see what you're saying. You look at this comic net, you look at this comic, this later issue, and it does look more quote unquote sophisticated versus what Ramona Freyden was doing. It just does. It looks more, this comic looks way more like Justice League now than Super Friends did under Ramona Freyden. And if you're looking for that, well, then you're like, okay, this book is getting more like that. It's not so much a kid's comic anymore.
Yeah. They had 2 Batman comics a month and 2 Superman and 2 Spider-Man. Why not 2 Justice Leagues?
Yeah, totally. Totally. I was always sort of stunned that obviously we know this book only has a couple of months left, that this thing that having a dedicated, I mean, we'll talk about this in subsequent episodes, but having a dedicated TV series every week didn't move copies of this book enough to keep it selling. That just seems amazing to me. I don't know why I keep being surprised at that, because there's so many examples of that exact thing not happening. And we've heard stories nowadays that, you know, we have these multi $100 million grossing, $1 billion grossing movies, and right. The comics don't budge, you know, so it just doesn't work that way, but it just seems so counterintuitive. You would just think, God, wouldn't a couple of thousand people go see Spider-Man and say, oh, you know what? Maybe I'd like to read a Spider-Man comic, but maybe not.
They need to put this rubberneck guy back into comics. He had some balls.
I love all these villains, man. Again, it's such a shame. I know that the Super Friends, for the most part, were completely left out of Who's Who. Not even for the most part, entirely. I mean, the Wonder Twins don't even get, Wendy and Marvin don't get listings in Who's Who, and they appeared in multiple issues. Wonder Twins were TV stars for Pete's sakes. But I would have loved, because the Plastic Man feature did run an adventure, and so that's not a Super Friends book. I would have loved like a single page of like the Plastic Man Rogues Gallery, you know, get them all, you know, Rubberneck and Putty Face and all these guys, you know, Brick Face. That would have been fun to get Joe Satan just to draw, you know, the group of like 12 of these plug ugly guys. That would have been a fun feature, but again.
Well, an appearance in Who's Who would have legitimized a major love from our childhoods.
Who was that?
No, I mean, it would have made it legit that Super Friends was in canon.
Oh, the book itself. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, of course. Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
That always bothered me. You know, it's like, hey, you know, come on. Jeez, yeah. DC. But so anyway, that is Super Friends number 45. So Chuck, thank you so much for coming on to talk about this.
Hey, no trouble. Anytime.
So let me ask you. Okay. I'm going to ask you just one more question about your merch, because I am fascinated by all this. So the stuff that you have, the Super Friends merch, right? Did you get any of it as a kid? Because one of the things that Chris Franklin and I love to talk about when we've been doing our merch segments is there was so much merchandise that was just sort of regular kind of crap. And then they slapped the Super Friends logo on it to get you to maybe move it. Like, oh, here's a, did you have stuff as a kid? Like, would Super Friends being on like a pair of sunglasses be something you were like, oh, now I want it because it's got Super Friends on it? Or is all that in your collection now, like you're collecting it as an adult?
In the early 70s, I decided that I was only going to participate in something if it could be superhero related. Mm. So I went to my mother and said, we have to start buying Superman peanut butter. She's like, get out of here.
Really? Did she reject you or did she do it?
Oh, yeah. I got rejected a lot.
Oh, I never liked Superman peanut butter, by the way. I never thought it tasted that great, which is, it broke my heart because I wanted it too.
Well, I felt like I was not being loyal. And there was even one point where I'm like, I can't be playing Star Wars with these figures.
Wow. You were diehard, man.
Yeah. So Han was Green Lantern and Luke was Aquaman and Leia was Wonder Woman and Chewbacca was the Shaggy Man.
That makes total sense.
Which I only knew about because of the Secret Origin Leaf candy comic.
Wow. You were hardcore.
But as far as my collection from my childhood, I am sorry to say that I only have three things from my actual childhood. We moved around, and every time we moved, my mom would get rid of toys.
Oh no.
My Migos, my Micronauts. What? My $6 million man. Yeah. And one time we moved, and the only toys that made the move was a little tin can of Mego, Buck Rogers, and Black Hole figures that I had brought with me in the car.
Oh, of all the ones to keep.
She decided.
Black Hole.
Well, they had the good joints.
Yeah, yeah.
Their joints were better. So if you're playing Super Friends, do you pick the Star Wars figures or the Black Hole figures?
Oh, man. Oh, Chuck, I feel so bad for you. I mean, like, moving from town to town is hard enough. And then to know you're going to lose your toy, there's going to be a toy purge on top of it?
She decided in sixth grade that I was too old for toys.
Oh,
It was a sad Christmas. But that was also the year that I finally started earning enough allowance to go to the stationery store regularly and pick my own comics.
There you go. Yeah. Wow. So
two of the items that survived are my dinky Enterprise toy and a giant yellow Superman beanbag that has been sewed and patched from some pillow fights as a kid.
That just breaks my heart, Chuck. That just really breaks my heart. Man, your mom was hardcore. I mean, was it? I'm sorry to keep going down this road. Now I'm fascinated by your tale of woe from a childhood. Was it space? Was it like we just don't have the space to be bringing boxes of toys in the car? Is that or?
Well, the Air Force would move your stuff.
Okay.
All you had to do is run around and stick blue stickers on things, and the Air Force would send a company, and they would all take it.
Oh. So
what we drove in the car, I mean, the our stuff would arrive separate. So for years, I was under the impression that maybe they only give a limited number of blue stickers.
Oh, man.
But I don't think that was it. I think it was they were all about Chuck needs to grow up. Chuck needs to be into sports. There was one year I got betrayed by Santa Claus, Rob.
Oh, no.
Santa Claus thought that I needed football cards.
Okay.
And Dallas Cowboy pajamas and a cork board with pins of all the helmets of the different team. I didn't give a crap about that.
Dude, did not take at all.
No.
Oh, man. Oh. Well, yeah, I mean, you got the last laugh, man, because you have this Hall of Justice sized collection of stuff. So good for you. And you're obviously not inflicting that pain on your own children because you just said they're reading comics and stuff. So,
right.
Wow.
And my youngest actually has a little collection of his own.
Good for him.
Actually takes ownership of my collection because he likes to come up here and help me do the displays or
Oh, that's so cool. Oh, that's cool, man.
Teen Titans show. I would love to do a toy podcast with you and Chris Franklin.
Oh, Chris is busy with House of Frankenstein and I'm busy with things, but part of it is I just want to hear Chris do, I just want to listen. You know, like I'm happy to talk it, but Chris is so knowledgeable on this stuff and he brings such energy to it that I'm always just kind of like, I just want to hear him do it. But that's something like we have to, I don't know, we all have to like brainstorm or something because that's just so, I could talk about that stuff all day. You know, I have I don't have that many toys much anymore. I got rid of them all, but I have little, you know, choice pieces here and there and they just make me so happy when I see them. Like I have my carded, I know we're doing Toy Talk, everybody, instead of Super Friends, but forgive me. The show's almost over. What are you going to complain about? But like I have my carded Flash Gordon action figure, on top of my Flash Gordon pinball machine.
Nice.
And you know, like every time I play it, it's there he is. I look right at him. Nice. It makes me so happy because I love that line. That line is so beautiful.
See, what I would go overboard and just start buying as many vintage Flash Gordon figures as I could find and do a whole little corner there.
You know, we don't have a ton of space. I do have a little, I will say, I do have a little Flash Gordon corner here in the studio because, you know, obviously the pinball machine it takes up the most amount of space. Damn thing's 500 pounds. But sitting on top of it, I have my Flash Gordon lunchbox, which was made by Dark Horse in the 90s. It's got all like Alex Raymond artwork on it, but it's on vintage or anything. And then leaning up against it is the action figure, like I mentioned. And then pinned, hanging on the wall to the right of the game is two Flash Gordon record albums I have.
Nice.
Featuring Alex Raymond artwork of Flash Gordon radio shows. So they're hanging. And I guess I should mention, since we're talking Flash Gordon, why not? Is just since I recorded the last episode of For All Mankind, I'm sure you've probably seen this photo on my Facebook page. Some of you probably have listening to this. I have since gotten my Flash Gordon pinball back glass signed by Sam Jones.
Oh, nice. I hadn't heard that. That's
yeah,
awesome.
He was at a convention that I was at just this weekend, and my wife's best friend, Rick, I've gotten him into going to these shows and he is all in now. And so we are like going to like all these, like once a month, we're going because there's always somewhere around the East Coast, we're going to one of these things. And there was one in Maryland and it was called like the Sci-Fi and Horror Convention in Maryland. I don't even remember the name of it. And it was funny, I had this lineup and I was like, oh, I'll go with Rick because he's going to go and get somebody from Poltergeist because he loves that movie. But I'm not that excited. There's nobody that I'm really that excited about. And then one day I just happened to look again and it said Sam Jones. I went, oh, oh. And so I bought a special box and I put the back glass in there and I brought it to him and he could not have been nicer. He was so excited when he saw it. That's was like, awesome. Oh, he's like, is that vintage? He's like, or is that a repro? I'm like, no, it's vintage. I told him the story and I got a photo of me and him. First of all, Sam Jones is huge, by the way. I'm 6 foot tall and he towers over me. Big dude. Could not have been nicer. It was a great experience. So now when I play Flash Gordon pinball, I can look at the signature of Sam Jones here on the left hand. So I'm very happy about that.
That's great. I just counted. I have 10 Flash Gordon figures within eyesight right now.
Damn, man. Damn, that's impressive. Well, thank you all for listening to Flash Gordon Cast. I hope you've been enjoying this backdoor pilot episode.
One more nugget for Chris Franklin's sake. Tell him I have the superpower cyborg.
Oh no. Don't let him know. Don't let him find out where you live, Chuck. Don't. Chris is a fine upstanding citizen, but he really wants that cyborg. So I would keep her location. Yeah, your house isn't a giant head of you, right? It's not anything anybody would notice.
We're still working on the afro.
Okay. Okay. All right. Fair enough. So, well, again, Chuck, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. I always enjoy talking to you, enjoying podcasting with you. So, and thanks everybody for listening. I want you to stay tuned. I'm going to run some commercial announcements. And when I come back, I'm going to do some listener feedback.
Hey, Sean, did you know that Batman Family Reunion is expanding?
Oh my God, what? Our episodes are now going to be 3 hours long?
No, no, no. Now that we have moved into Detective Comics, we are going to see stories starring other members of the, let's say, extended Batman family, like the Human Target.
Well, he's a detective.
The Demon.
He's been in Batman Family before.
Elongated Man.
He's a detective.
Red Tornado.
He's been in Batman Family before.
Black Lightning.
Ooh, he's cool.
And the Atom.
He's small. I'm excited by the upcoming artists. Not only are we still going to see my favorite, Michael Glorious Golden, but we will see art by Don Newton, Dick Giordano, Irv Novik, Jose Delbo, Johnny Craig, and even Steve Ditko and Dan Spiegel.
Awesome, but we won't forget the original stars. We'll see Robin return to the big top and Babs discover a family secret. Man-Bat teams up with Jason Bard, Batman teams up with Batgirl, and we will finally get an all-new Alfred story. We will see villains like Maxi Zeus, the Riddler, the Crime Doctor, and the Truckers.
But Paul, you know people say that the best part about the reunion is getting to interact with our Bat cousins. I personally think it's all of the food, but I understand their point of view. We are continuing our guest list, including some repeat visits, but also some new Bat relatives. We love that our show has become a real family reunion, and we can't wait for you to hear what we have planned. That's the Batman Family Reunion on all of your podcast apps, only on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
TV. Check. Cosmic Arc cartridge. Check. Power.
Cosmic Arc is a game cartridge for the Atari video system.
Meteor! I got it!
The Cosmic Arc searches out strange creatures on distant planets.
Beam them up!
But the deeper the Arc travels in space, the tougher it gets.
Beam them up and get back to Earth!
Boys, clean your room. We're back.
Cosmic Arc by Imagic. The video system must be bought separately and connected to the TV by your parents.
And now it's time for listener feedback, and these are the comments we got on our previous episode of For All Mankind, episode 44, with my guest Brian Hyler. First up is Captain Entropy, who says, "Top of the morning to you, Faith and Begarla. I have not yet had the pleasure of listening to the Craig on offer for All Mankind this morning. However, paging through the gallery, I can see that this may finally be the issue with a jack-o'-lantern tale that tickles your fancy. That's my wager, at any rate, and if I'm wrong, I owe you all the gold at the end of the rainbow." I just read that top of the morning to you was considered a popular greeting in Ireland over 100 years ago, but not at all now. So 23 skidoo, everybody. Also, lest I offend Jimmy McGlinchey or any other genuine Irish people, please think of this as an impression of the 1966 Batman show's Chief O'Hara, or maybe the Lucky Charms leprechaun, but not an actual Irish person. Yes, Captain Entropy, because the host that you're listening to right now, Rob Kelly, is certainly not an Irish person. I don't know why you had to feel you had to go all the way out of Jimmy McGlinchey to find one. Anyway, Brian, and also you were dead wrong. Brian Chufo, the setup for this issue is amazing. The heroes suddenly forget their heroic identities and go about their daily lives is usually a fun story trope. The amount of time spent with Superman made me think it was originally a plot for the New Adventures of Superboy, which was being published at the same time. I've definitely seen Superboy do the cape as a parachute stunt in one of those issues as a backup story, describing the first time he flew to a planet with a red sun. I'll pretend everything after page four never happened, none of the other heroes were involved, and attribute Superman's selective amnesia to red kryptonite. Sean Ann Myers, of course, from this very network, says, "Welcome to the podcast, Brian. You were great. Whenever I see human heads on animal creatures, I think about the dog in Invasion of the Body Snatchers, 1978 version, and it creeps me out all over again. I like the way that Romeo Tangle draws Aquaman's hair. I think it looks very modern. I think this issue's best friend award should go to Jaina. By her constantly trying to reach the heroes by phone, she talks to Alfred and realizes that something is wrong. Then she and Zan race into action, and even when Green Fury couldn't help them, she uses her bracelet to snap all the heroes out of their delusion, and then she captures the villain." Fair enough, Sean. Bucky749 says, "Wonderful show. Great guest. I'm a big fan of Toy Ventures. Really enjoyed the surprise for all merch kind." Thank you, Bucky. Edo Boznar says, "All right, since no one brought it up, I have to ask, what the heck is Peter Parker doing in that jack-o'-lantern story? Otherwise, the idea of Superman using his cape as a parachute to land safely because he forgot to fly reminds me of that scene at the start of one of those post-Burton Batman movies when Batman and Robin survive jumping out of an exploding aircraft by sky surfing on pieces of debris or something similar." That was Batman and Robin, Ado. Captain Entropy is back, and he says, "Thanks for a great episode about an odd tale. Brian's really funny." Yes, he is. "Sorry, the jack-o'-lantern tale still managed to disappoint. I had high hopes for me boyo. I do want to certify that Wonder Woman's need for rest after a hard day at the Pentagon is totally legit. I'm pretty sure I was thinking back to those Calgon commercials even in the late 2000s. Brett Young says, great show, Rob and Brian. Strange things are afoot on this cover. Monsters with the hero's own faces on them. Sure, it's bizarre and a little disturbing. If they had shown Robin on the last page eating a pork chop, that would have taken the story to its natural conclusion. And what a story. I love Superman's tiny clothes. I could use that system as my wife slowly takes over all the closet space. And how about Bruce Wayne's FU money lifestyle? He's chilling out in a smoking jacket and ascot on a purple leather lounge chair, and it's like noon. He's got massive Gone with the Wind drapes, sheet of print ceiling lamps, and a bunch of ferns. All he's missing is a Coke mirror and some Phil Collins playing on cassette, and he's completed his 80 rich asshole starter kit. I thought we might be on our way to a whole issue of Wonder Woman and Skippy sleepwear, but oh great, here come the Thompson twins to gum up the works. They are easily captured by conveniently walking out of the Hall of Justice and standing very still so the alien ship hovering over can lower traps and ensnare them. Duh, what's that, Jaina? Just the worst. You know, Marvin may have been a bit of a dullard, but at least he and the dog knew when to run. Green Fury was right to peace out and leave them to their doom. By the way, Rob, a terrific Shills in Your Nail reference during the show. Bravo, sir. Thought you'd appreciate that, Brett. Dick Grayson got an odd pulsation from under his belt. Take it easy. We haven't even rung Judy's doorbell yet, am I right? Once again, Aquaman is without so much as a punch. Well, here we go again, off to outer space to rescue Ashford and Simpson. Solid as a rock. I swear, if the one kid was on my own walking swimming pool, I'd feed them to Topo. Man, I'm thirsty. I grab a bottle of water, but I can't find it because we're in a goddamn invisible plane. And now I'm fighting a crustacean with my face on it. Is that how my hair looks? The stylist said it's totally the look right now, but I don't know. Now that I see it on a giant lobster, I'm not so sure. Maybe I should ask Wonder Woman her opinion. Oh, fight's over? We're all done? Okay, great. Let's get out of here. Ah, crap. I left my weed on the invisible plane. I'll never find it now. Brett, I will really miss your flights of fancy in these comments as the show wraps up in a couple of months. Anyway, thanks so much, everybody, for the comments. You know I enjoy them. And, of course, big thanks to Chuck Dill for stopping by and talking Super Friends with me. You can find all the back episodes of For All Mankind over on the website, friendwaterpodcast.com. You can find us on Twitter at For All Mankind SF. You can subscribe to the show. I don't know why you would at this point, since we're almost done, on any podcatcher of your choice. And then finally, if you want to support the Find Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW podcasts. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is new name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Chuck Dill. There he is again. Stanford M. Brown, Donald McWaters, Gord Tolton, and David S. Gutierrez for their support of For All Mankind. I appreciate it. So that is going to do it. Thanks for listening to For All Mankind. Join us next episode when we will look at Super Friends number 46, The Conqueror's Greatest Contest.
An FW TV podcast.